let's talk about how executive functions develop. So as we know, executive functions guide behavior. They reside in the prefrontal cortex, and these executive functions, about 11 or 12 of them, have been identified, and they work together as a team of conductors to light up parts of the brain, frequently in collaboration with each other, so that we can move through life planning and organizing and doing things that are very complicated and multi-layered. When we're born, when a baby is born, brain structures, myelination, the process of the fatty sheath developing around the neurons to speed the transmission of the chemical reactions, the electrical impulses that send one message from one neuron to another, and neurotransmitter reactions are not fully developed. Individual physiology, genetics, and the patterns of human interactions between infants and caretakers all influence the development of neural circuitry. What is the order of the emergence of these executive functions? So the first thing that emerges is response inhibition, and that's the ability to think before you act. If there's a behavioral aspect to it, the ability to delay a response leading to an immediate consequence. So if I put my hand on something hot and it hurts me, I'm going to try to know not to put my hand on something hot. I'm going to inhibit that response, that urge to touch that hot thing. A response inhibition stops ongoing behaviors when they're unsuccessful, manages distractions that interfere with other cognitive functions, and it starts at about age 3 and is usually developed by the age of 13. Nonverbal memory is the ability to represent people and events in the mind, hindsight, foresight, and it's kind of like a spatial sketch pad. Emotional control, we call this self-regulation. This is the ability to manage your emotions to achieve goals and direct behavior. At about 6 months, an infant develops a basic ability to hold an image in his or her mind and move towards something. And this happens to dovetail nicely with the mobility skills that are developing physically at that time. Flexibility. This is the executive function that helps us revise plans in light of new information and supports adaptability to change. We see this in young children all the time. You know, they try something, they try to put a square peg in a round hole and it doesn't work, and then they go to the square hole and they put the square peg in there. They've revised their plan in light of the new information that didn't fit. Sustained attention. This is the ability to maintain attention to a situation or task regardless of fatigue, boredom, or distractibility. The next one to develop is initiation of tasks, the ability to start tasks without too much procrastination or delay. We're going to continue reviewing how these executive functions develop. So internalization of speech, which is called verbal working memory. This is using words to communicate thoughts, feelings, and self-talk. Vygotsky has a model of how language becomes private and internalized, and it's very relevant to this particular executive function, and it's very important with people who have ADHD. So from 0 to 3, children will speak to others. They don't really have a mind's voice. Whatever they think comes right out. Between the ages of 4 and 5, the voice turns a little bit back on themselves, and they talk out loud to themselves. They'll often say, I do this, or, they'll name themselves and as they're doing an activity. They'll talk themselves through things. Around the ages of 6 to 8, there's a shift from description to instruction. The voice in your head develops around age 7, and by age 9, there is no longer any publicly observable speech. So what that means is that around 4, what the child will do is say, "I make a picture." Around 6, the child will say, I want you to make a picture of, you know, trees, or the self-talk is less about description. Or if the child will talk to himself and say, I'm making a picture, and let's see, I think I want to put some trees here and some flowers here. So they talk themselves through their activities. That's very common from 6 to 8. Between ages 7 and 9, the voice that we all have in our heads of kind of talking ourselves through things silently develops. And by about 9, generally most kids don't talk themselves through things out loud. With ADHD, kids continue to think and talk aloud most of the time because they can't do it in their brains. There's a failure to internalize that speech. The switch is broken. And actually, it's quite helpful for them to be able to talk themselves through an activity because it's a way that they organize themselves. In terms of the next executive function, planning and prioritizing, planning creates a roadmap to reach a goal. You divide complex behavioral sequences into different components to solve new problems, or attain new goals. And it also is an ability to find a good fit between a problem and a solution. The ability to make decisions about what's important and what's not. So planning and prioritizing are very important skills that need to develop, particularly as a child becomes and wants to become more independent. So if I want to go out with my friends, then I'll have to do my homework before I go out. Or if I want to go out with my friends and I need a ride from my mom, I have to ask her more than 5 minutes before the event. So those kinds of things are very helpful and important to learn how to do. Organization, another executive function, which is the ability to create and maintain systems to keep track of your information and stuff. That would develop probably next. Time management. Time management is tough, as I've said. It is the ability to develop accurate time estimation for tasks. How much time do you have? How you allocate it, how to budget it, and how to keep within deadlines. This is extremely difficult for people with ADHD. And actually, one of the ways that I work with them on this particular executive function limitation is backward design. So we start with when they have to be somewhere and go backwards using an example from their lives of something that's happened recently. How long does it take? What time? What time? What time? And to really accurately, as much as possible, assess how much time things take. And then we add a little extra, 10 minutes, because things almost always take longer than we expect. But backward design is helpful for them. It's very concrete. Forward design does not work as well because of the planning challenges that go along with having ADHD. Persistence to achieve a goal. This is another key executive function. So we call this persistence or sustained attention, and it's the capacity to follow through on something without being waylaid by competing interests. And it really depends on immediate versus delayed gratification. So for people with ADHD, they tend to want immediate gratification. Unfortunately, a lot of things that we have to do in the world, particularly in school, rely on delayed gratification. So you have to learn how to develop the ability to sustain your attention in the context where you're operating. So we call that goal-directed persistence, and it relies on context-dependent sustained attention. In plainer, more simpler terms, if you want to be able to stick with your focus and stay with your goal, you have to be able to sustain your attention regardless of the context that you're in. And one of the problems for people with ADHD is that they actually have trouble doing that. So if the context changes, their ability to sustain attention changes, which makes sense because that's true for all of us sometimes, but they have trouble regrouping and refocusing. Metacognition. This is one of my favorites, actually, because it's something that really I've seen change over time in a number of my clients as they've matured. And as they've come to therapy, this skill can be developed, and it's very important. So metacognition is involves self-regulation, as we talked about what that is, the control of emotions, arousal, and the ability to take perspectives. The ability to take perspectives is very hard for children and teenagers with ADHD. Mostly, metacognition involves using working memory to talk and look back on past experiences and situations, see what you did, look at a current situation, and evaluate if you need to make changes on what you're doing. The key to metacognition is the ability to step back and take a bird's eye view of yourself and ask yourself, how am I doing? How are others perceiving me? Is there something that I'm missing? This is hard because there's a lot of shame related to ADHD, embarrassment about missing things, and anxiety about trying to get whatever you're missing. So I want to talk a little bit more about how executive function skills develop. So as I said, they start in infancy and they continue into adolescence. And basically, there's an external to internal process. And we talked earlier about how parents often are the executive functions early on for their children in terms of helping them learn to inhibit their responses, learn to, you know that that's hot, that's hot. They, you know, you don't want to touch that. So they learn, they teach them that. Or they'll, as I said, help them figure out that, you know, you actually put your pants on before you put your shoes on, kind of a thing. And eventually, the things that parents teach them from the outside, or teachers work with them on, or you as therapists will work with your clients on, will become internalized to them. And they'll start to absorb the routines and the processes that we're trying to help them become more aware of. There is a parallel development of the brain and executive functioning skills. So as the brain changes over the trajectory of childhood, adolescence, into young adulthood, so do the executive functioning skills. In puberty, the size and quantity of neural networks dramatically increase, especially in the frontal lobes and the cerebellum. And there's also what I've referred to before as increased myelination. So the thickening of the fatty sheath around the neural cells that's in the corpus callosum that connects the left and right sides of the brain. So this proliferation of brain cells is followed by a period of pruning the networks so that the system will operate as efficiently as possible. And the increase in the myelination in the corpus callosum is critical for the more complex use of language and logical thinking and metacognition that we see in later adolescence and early adulthood. So if we look at the development of executive function skills, that these executive function skills have to be taught directly. The frontal lobes are still developing, and so the skills have to be taught thinking about them as concrete skills, not an innate thing that you should just know, because no one comes into the world knowing them. They need to be taught. Teaching executive function skills increases the probability of academic success and better self-esteem. It's important to remember that the dopamine and norepinephrine pathways in the brain are especially slow to develop, so that rather than being angry and frustrated and blaming kids for what they can't do, we would do much better to think about this as a developmental sequence problem with a deficit of skills. How do we assess executive functioning skills? Well, we conduct a multidimensional assessment. So that would include understanding the pattern of strengths and weaknesses in the child's executive function skills. So the two critical things that we want to look at are sustained attention and initiation. And these are not accounted for in standardized testing because the tester, the evaluator will say, okay, you know, start. So the person starts. We want to get a bunch of information, and that would include classroom observations, work samples, behavior checklists such as the BRIEF, the Brown ADD scales, the CBCL, the Vanderbilt scales, or the BASC, and, of course, a thorough history from parents and from teachers. We want to rely on the process, what we observe and know about this child, rather than just the scores. Diagnostics tools include a thorough history from two separate parties, parents, teachers, the child, him or herself, if that's possible, sibling or partner. Neuropsychological testing can be very helpful. Hallowell recommends the quantitative electroencephalogram, the QEEG. I find the Barclay ADHD and executive function forms very helpful, and I also find the forms from Dawson and Guare's books, Smart but Scattered and Smart but Scattered Teens, and they have another book, I think, of just assessing executive function skills to be really useful, user-friendly, and extremely informative. Let's talk a little bit about the spectrum of executive function. What does it cover in the brain? So the thing is that you can have executive functions and ADHD, which overlap with executive functions, and learning disabilities, which overlap with executive functions. So it's really a broad term, and it has a lot of consequences for how someone functions. All psychiatric and learning disorders interfere with attention. But it's important to remember that ADHD is a working memory deficit. I think it's important that you take a whole child approach when you work with kids with ADHD. You know, there's a false belief that if you fix a dysfunctional component of a child, then you fix the child. So if the child has reading trouble and you fix that, then you fix the child. And really, you know, it doesn't always work that way. So we want to think about what helps the whole child manage. As we know, there are three types of learning disabilities, reading, mathematics, and disorders of written expression, that are especially challenging and have been found to be associated with ADHD. How do we intervene to improve executive functions? Well, we intervene, for one, at the level of the environment. What are the expectations of the tasks? What are the prompts to perform the tasks? How do the adults interact with the children? We intervene at the level of the person, improving the individual's capacity to use his or her own executive skills through motivation, increased awareness of what those skills or deficits are, and instruction. We shift gradually from external to internal dimensions. So we shift from making a checklist that we hang on the refrigerator to, over time, hoping that parts of that checklist become internalized, which they will, when there's consistency. We target only one or two specific behaviors for change at a time. There are three key strategies for managing weaknesses of executive functioning. You, as I said, you intervene at the level of the environment, you intervene at the level of the child, and that means you teach the skill, you motivate the child to use the skill, and you praise or reward the child for using the skill. And then you verbalize what you see happening so that the child gets another piece of feedback and another way of externalizing what becomes internal. General interventions to assist improving executive function skills are based on the following questions. What are your primary goals? What do you most want to target first? And then what? And then what? If you want to target three or four things at the same time, and many clients come in and they want to fix everything, you'll fail. Pick the most important thing and work on that. And when there's some success with that, Then you can go on to the next most important thing. Use worksheets and information from the child, parents, and teachers to determine these. Remember that all goals should improve self-awareness, self-adjustment, and metacognition, thinking about how the self is in the world. The best plans, the best ones, are developed collaboratively with the child and the parents. If the child does not buy in to what a parent thinks is the most important thing, the child will not actually be fully participatory. We want the child to also see what's most important. And if sometimes what the child sees as most important is his or her number one, is the parent's number four or five, I have to tell you that I'll lean in to the child's choice because I want the child to start to feel like he or she has some authority and autonomy in creating the change that will help him or her feel better. Another intervention that's really important is modifying the environment. So what parts of the environment are not supporting change for this particular child? What ways could people interact with this child differently? What are expectations of this child that aren't working? If we think back to the client I referred to earlier who had a teacher who was giving her spelling tests, even though her IEP said no spelling tests, one of the ways that she was able to modify her environment with her parents' support and her strategies teacher's support was to basically confront the teacher and say, I am not supposed to take spelling tests. So that was a modification of the environment. And then the final way to intervene is you want to describe the behavior that is troubling or isn't working in very specific concrete terms. Otherwise, it becomes an always kind of a thing. And when something is an always kind of a thing, people with ADHD don't get it. Because as soon as they hear always, their brain sort of turns off. But if they hear, remember when you did this specific thing, then they will actually be able to look at that specific thing. How do we modify the environment? So the first way to modify the environment is to collaborate with the child first and ask what situations have helped you foster completion of tasks or using some of these executive functioning skills successfully in the past. So when we have that information, then we want to think about if we can establish a goodness of fit between the child's skills and a particular environment. What we are talking about is antecedent control. We want to modify the situation which triggers the maladaptive behavior and lack of skills. So we want to alter the physical or social situation as much as possible. We want to amend the tasks expected of the child. And we want to change how the adult interacts with the child. And this, of course, is all true for teenagers. I'm just using child for ease of language. But those are the goals that we want to think about. Another way that we can, you know, really intervene in helping improve executive functions are that we want to reduce distractions for students. And sometimes that will mean creating physical barriers, fences, removing breakable objects, locking rooms, a tool shed, putting away controls to the video games, reducing the social complexity of situations, changing a social dynamic. We want to reduce distractions. We want there to be a place for everything. Cubbies, bins, hampers, calendars, files, notebooks, and we want to teach the children how to file. You know, when you get papers from a teacher and they're three hole punched, they should go into the binder with each hole in a ring, not shoved into the folder section. You want to help teach organization. And here's the piece of information some parents really don't want to hear. Until they're practically out of high school, freshmen and sophomores still need the kind of assistance with organization if they have ADHD that 6th, 7th, and 8th graders do. It may be somewhat different, but they will need some help with their organization. In terms of electronics, I would like to say that most teenagers, and I would say a lot of kids now even, from ages 12 and up, have a phone, an iTouch, or, you know, fancy watch or something like that. Those three devices are going to be their best friend because most kids, if you ask them where X, Y, or Z is, they don't know. But they always know where their phone is or their iTouch. And so we want to use the iTouch or the phone or, you know, some comparable kinds of devices to help them organize, put items in their calendar, set alarms to remember, oh, I got to take my pills or I have an appointment. And we want to use those as much as possible because the phone or the iTouch or whatever is with them most of the time, whereas the notebook, the calendar notebook, may not be. And that might require doing things twice, or it might require basically writing down things in the notebook at school and then having an alarm set in the phone, you know, when it's time to do your homework. Check calendar for homework. Rehearse with a child what will happen in advance of a particular situation. So if you have a child who gets really overwhelmed in social situations and you're having Thanksgiving at Aunt Shirley's house and there's going to be 25 people, it would be worth taking some time to talk to that child about what's going to happen at Aunt Shirley's house and how you or he can work on when he feels overwhelmed or might need a break, or maybe you want to institute a break where you and your child go up to a room and just chill out for a few minutes, but that you plan and talk about an event that you know could be challenging for your child in advance. Use verbal prompts. We want parents to use verbal prompts to remind the child to check a schedule. So, for example, a lot of parents I work with complain that they have to say the same thing over and over and over again. From the time a child can read, and even if a child can't read because you can do a checklist with pictures of items, you can put up a list for your child of things that you want him or her to do and basically say over and over, check your list, check your list. And when things are done on the list, they can have a pen and check them off. That is extremely helpful because it teaches the child the ability to go back and see what has to be done when something's finished and to start to understand that there's a sequence. I do this, then I do this, then I do this. So there are steps to a process. I think you want to help the parents give praise for using executive skills with their children. So when their child is actually checking the list, to say, in the car on the way to school, I noticed you checked your list and did everything on it. Way to go. They don't have to go overboard, but some noticing that the child's making an effort in the direction you want him or her to go in. In terms of modifications, I believe that a lot of times what happens is that parents make tasks too long and complicated for their children to be able to follow through. So we want to do shorter steps and shorter tasks. And you want to take a task and divide it into parts with breaks built in. So I have a client, and she hyper-focuses when she does homework. So she'll sit down and she'll work for 3 hours. She's not particularly productive, but she zones in and she can't decide what's important. And so recently I gave her the assignment that when she goes to do her homework, she can work for an hour, which is what she thinks is her longest period of a reasonable period of time. She's 17. And then she has to take a break for 10 minutes, which is timed, and then she'll go back for another hour so that she actually can learn how to break. She doesn't have that mechanism, so we're trying to teach that for her, and it will be in her phone. So we want to help these kids make a schedule and then stick with the schedule. And sometimes the challenge is because of the high likelihood that a child who has, or a teen who has ADHD, has a parent who has ADHD. It's very hard for these parents to remain consistent with the schedule that's created. So the schedule that's created has to be simple enough to follow and simple enough to follow through on. You want to make steps explicit, no assumptions. So if you think, well, you do this, and then of course this one, you do one thing, you on the list, then if, you know, go to the bathroom, and you assume that in the bathroom there's also teeth brushing that occurs. Mm-mm. Go to the bathroom, brush your teeth, put your shoes on. You assume maybe you get your coat at the same time? No. No assumptions in the beginning. Include choices for a child. So the child doesn't feel like, oh my God, I'm being controlled with everything I have to do. You want the child to be able to make choices within the schedule or goals that you're setting up. And because there's collaboration with the child, then the child will be involved in what you're setting up. In terms of specific modifications in a classroom, that can include changing seat arrangements, basically looking at what's happening at the playground or free play or lunch, where the child's sitting at lunch. In terms of making tasks shorter and taking breaks, the end of the task has to be in sight. If your child's goal is to write a paper in one sitting, that will be a failed experience. If your child's goal is to write a page of words, that might go better. Make steps very specific and vary the tasks so that there are choices. And watch out for open-ended tasks like creative or expository writing that have no end. You have to create, even if it's self-induced or sort of a false barrier, that they can hit up against it and feel a sense of completion, and then the next time they'll have a little bit more to do. I want to say something about the complexity of social situations, particularly for younger children. Parents of children with ADHD have to provide supervision and some influence over social events for these kids. It's very hard for these children to manage the situations on their own. Because of all of the things we've talked about in terms of executive functioning and some of the challenges, so that the parents will need to check in. The parents might need to participate in the play dates. Even at ages 8 and 9, the parents are 10, the parents may need to check in, structure a particular snack time, engage the kids in a game. A child with ADHD may sometimes feel lost in a play date, not sure what to do, or it gets boring. So the parent will need to be somewhat engaged, which sometimes is a little challenging for parents because they think, oh, play date, free time for me. I can catch up on X, Y, and Z. And that isn't necessarily the case. How do we teach executive function skills to ADHD kids? So as I said, and I've really tried to emphasize in this talk, there's a philosophy of a skill deficit rather than a failure of will, motivation, or knowledge. One of the ways to teach these skills, in fact, I think it's the only way, is you have to teach the deficient skills directly. Do not expect these kids to absorb these skills through observation or what I call miracle osmosis. The first thing that has to occur is you must consider the child's developmental stage and understand what is typical for that age group. Then, you need to be able to help the parents, and you will have to do sometimes in session, cue the child for tasks. Keep the tasks brief. Encourage practice using small steps. Work with the child's desire for mastery and control. That's really important. It's important to remember that these kids want to change. They want things to be different and better for them. And that is your best tool as a therapist. Create and keep routines and schedules. This is the third most important thing. You need to help these families create and keep routines and schedules that are not too complicated and that are accessible and involve the participation of the child. It's important for parents and the child to distinguish between have to and want to. So there are two kinds of tasks, really. Ones that you're not very good at doing and ones that you're capable of doing but don't like doing. So both of these have to be broken down into smaller steps. If you're not good at it, then there are a whole set of separate issues that have to go on, which is like a lack of motivation, a dread of doing something, an avoidance. So that's one category. And then the second category is you can do it, but you just don't like it. So there's also things like avoidance and a lack of desire to actually do it. So in both cases, these kinds of tasks are have-to tasks, and they have to be broken down into small, manageable chunks so that you can kind of do something you don't like or you know how to do but you still don't like or you can't do. Do a small piece of it, break. Do a small piece of it, break. Because ADHD kids and teens do not have the ability to sustain themselves through an activity that they do not like or feel like they cannot do. You can model as a therapist for these kids. Well, if this were my assignment, I might, or when I write a paper, I plan to do this or that, or this is how I take breaks. Not because you want to basically explain that your way is the best way, but because it's helpful for these kids to understand that other people struggle also with having to do tasks they don't like, having to do things that they know how to do but they don't want to do, and having to do things that they don't know how to do. They need to hear what other people's strategies are. So not only from you, but also from family members. Remember that what these kids do in their brain and to themselves is a lot of shaming, that I'm different and I don't do it right. One of the goals of teaching executive functioning skills is to enhance self-regulatory capacities. So the ability to push through something, even if you don't like it, to manage your emotions, even if you're struggling or you're mad or you're afraid. To use charts, visual symbols and aids, make lists. As I said, daily calendars for daily activities. There never can be enough visual aids up for kids with ADHD. Build in choices to give kids some control. So you have math homework, which you don't like, and you have Spanish, which you also don't like, and you have English, which you like, and science, which you like. So how do we want to plan our evening with these two things you don't like and the two that you do? Ask the child. And the child might say, I want to do the things I like first and the things I dislike next. Or I want to do something I don't like, then something I do. Then something I don't like, then something I do. Ask the child for his or her feedback so that he feels like he's participating in what's being set up. Okay, so in terms of teaching executive functioning skills to kids, one thing that's important to remember is that punishment actually doesn't teach children what to do. It teaches them what not to do. And what kids with ADHD need are some ideas about what to do. They need help figuring out what's next. So one thing is to rehearse, practice, and review skills before an event. As we said, use verbal prompts or reminders. Arrange for visual cues or alarms. Praise the child or teen for using new skills. And here's the key. Debrief and review a situation afterwards. Maybe at the time, maybe 3 days later, but something that you saw that was good or different. That's what you want the parents to be able to do. And if sometimes they can't debrief something until they're in therapy, then you can do it there. It's important to teach parents that effective praise is delivered immediately, is specific to the particulars of the action that you've seen, states the values of accomplishment, notices hard work, and trains the child to appreciate his or her own task accomplishment and problem solving. That's how we're going to teach metacognition. So we want to interrupt the child before the child interrupts you and say, I really like how you're doing this. You want to praise the children for using executive skills. I like three positives for each corrective feedback. So each time you say, do it this way or don't do it this way, that you try to remember to notice a couple good things at the same time. People ask me a lot about bribing. What's a bribe? So I'm going to talk about my view of bribes. So a bribe is when you say to someone, here's the money, take this bag across the street. An incentive is, if you take this bag across the street, I'll give you some money. Now, I don't believe in bribes, but I do believe in incentives, and I have seen them work in the 25 years that I've been a family and child therapist. We want to use incentives and self-rewards to enhance motivation and instruction. So you might make a deal with a child that he works for an hour, does his homework, and gets 10 minutes of Facebook time. Or you might make a deal with a child that after homework comes the half hour of TV that she's allowed. Those kinds of things are really helpful. And the agreement would go further. If you don't do your homework or you have a tantrum about doing your homework, then there will be no TV for you. And that is very hard for some parents to follow through on, but it's critical that the incentive actually matters to the child and isn't available if the child doesn't do what he or she has agreed to do. Incentives make an effort of learning a skill and doing a task less distasteful. They also teach gratification. What reward can I give myself or motivation can I give to get through this unpleasant task? We want to make sure that adults offer enough support to help a child feel successful, but not too much support to be doing things for the child. Adults usually make two mistakes. There's too much support so that the child fails to learn independence, or too little support so that the child repeatedly fails at a task. That's a really fine line to balance, and it's really important that you work with your clients on that. You want to practice in session teaching negotiation and compromise. This is something that's often really hard for people. They're not good at it. They're especially triggered and reactive to things that bother them about their child or their partner or the dynamic in the family. And it's critical, critical that you help them with this. Scaffolding is crucial, and it usually takes a lot longer than expected in terms of how much time it has to be in place. So what happens is usually we create a system or support, a level of support or some sort of routine, and it's working. Yay! Then what happens is adults usually take it out too soon. And this is particularly true in school systems where, you know, a child will have extra support and be doing well, and then they'll want to remove that support the next year, which is a big mistake. Big. Because the child usually needs the support longer to make sure that those kinds of changes are internalized. So you don't want to abruptly stop supports, supervision, or incentives. Whatever there are supports that are being faded out, they have to be faded out gradually. There are five keys to executive skill development. Often over-involved parents can be anxious and they have trouble backing off from their kids who've needed a lot of support, who have ADHD, and so as a result, the kids sometimes are under-responsible for their own activities and actions, We want to help create more accountability in the kids. This is particularly true of teenagers, and have the adults step back in appropriate ways but still stay involved in other ways. So, for example, where the notebooks are concerned, it's, you know, sophomore year, and you might want to take your kid to, you know, Office Depot or Staples or, you know, wherever, and, you know, say, okay, how are we going to organize this year? Where are you going to put stuff? And help them lay it out. Next year, it's junior year, have the discussion. Maybe they want to do it themselves. Maybe you want to look at it when it's done, but you're involved in the process. You want to help those parents use collaboration to create mutual goals of what should be shared and what can be independent. And you want to rely on the child's sense of what works for him or her, as well as the parental observations about that. It's important for parents to be very clear about goals and expectations from the very beginning of any sort of arrangement that they're setting up with their children. And to make their goals, the steps for a goal, into a checklist. So, for example, if you're working with a family and the parents complain that the room is a disaster, and the child needs to clean the room, then it would seem to me that perhaps, and this is true for a lot of kids, they see their room, it's like a disaster area. It's overwhelming. They don't even know where to begin. And so it might be useful to make a checklist that goes in their desk or on their door, you know, to clean their room. One, clear off the bed. Two, put the dirty clothes in the hamper. Three, fold all the clothes that are in a heap. You know, those kinds of things, they seem so simple and basic, but they're really important because the child isn't able to do that internally, him or herself. You want to help the parents create expectations of tasks that the child can actually perform and succeed on, not, you know, continue to basically fail at, and which perpetuates a cycle of anger and disappointment and shame. And you want to help the parents make the steps of every single task explicit. How do you help kids with ADHD develop emotional control? Well, the first thing is to identify triggers, events that cause the child to lose his or her temper. The second thing to remember is that emotional control is one of the executive functions that takes years to develop. So that would mean that it's important to make a list of triggers, you know, what you can and cannot do when you're having a hard time with the child or the teen. The third thing is to enact a practice session and connect the process to a reward. So, Basically, you want to help create and review what happens when a child is triggered, what the options are, and what happened, and what could be done differently. So it's important to create a plan to manage or eliminate the triggers, to talk about what losing your temper looks like, and to create a list of behaviors that are not tolerated regardless of how angry or upset you are. And that list has to be short and extremely specific and concrete. And then you want to make another list, a list of replacement behaviors, things a child can do when he or she is upset instead of those other things. So that can be listening to music, that can be having, you know, a soft pillow or something in the basement that the child can sort of thwop if needed. That can be taking a walk with the dog. Whatever is appropriate for that child, there should be a list of alternatives. In terms of school interventions, the first thing that I think is really worth stating many times is that the parents must advocate for their kids over and over and over again. They have to continue to advocate for their kids. I'm going to read something from the book that's on your reference list called Buzz. and it's about homework. It's Friday afternoon, and I'm in my writing shed chewing sugarless tangerine gum and agonizing over a clunky first draft, longing as always for distraction, although I wouldn't have ordered this phone call. The voice belongs to Buzz's English teacher, who is graciously taking time to let me know he hasn't turned in a major assignment due today, which, it's news to me, he should have been working on for the past week. Buzz is in middle school. The instruction was to interview someone, preferably a parent, about prejudice. Buzz hasn't even gotten started. His teacher isn't sure why that is, but again, graciously, and maybe also because I've met with her 3 times by now to plead for understanding, she offers Buzz a reprieve as long as he can do this work over the weekend. Whenever I ask Buzz if he has homework these days, he tells me that he has already finished it at school. He won't write assignments in his agenda, even when Xbox time depends on it, and there is little else he cares about other than food, which I'm not ready yet to withhold. So when Buzz comes home this afternoon, I leave my shed, microwave him a plate of leftover spaghetti, and spend the next half hour arguing, bribing, threatening, pulling out the TV cord and hiding it before finally convincing him to get started. The two of us, I'm well aware, are trapped in an all but senseless system, even as U.S. teachers are piling on ever more homework. Research has shown it doesn't measurably improve academic achievement in grade school, although it can sour kids' attitudes towards school and increase conflict between them and their parents. I should probably spend more time complaining about this to Buzz's principal, who already thinks I'm a crank. But in the short term, I just don't want him to fail. It drives me crazy that I have to work this hard. And it makes me so sad to think of all the worried mothers who don't even have this option. Finally, he sits down in front of the computer. He smooths out the crumpled blue instruction sheet we fished from the bottom of his backpack, a trove of ancient cookie crumbs, leaking pens, unsigned permission slips, and unwashed gym shorts, and he starts typing fast. So here we have a boy of maybe 12 or 13 and a mother who is really struggling with how to get him motivated, started, following through, accountable, all of the things that I see in the parents I work with of ADHD kids. So parents have to advocate for their kids, even if the principal thinks they're a crank. It's important to remember that ADHD kids can't bind events across time. To remember that transitions, physical relocations, changes in schedule and disruptions are especially difficult for the child with ADHD. Changing classes, starting a new year, having a substitute teacher, all of these things can be very discombobulating. It's important to teach ADHD kids how to keyboard as quickly as possible. Often because there's a motoric aspect of ADHD, the physical act of writing is very difficult. And as we've said, sometimes actually, you know, the thinking and language parts and expressing them verbally are very difficult. So it's good to keyboard. It helps speed things along. It's important in a classroom to avoid distracting stimuli by not placing the child near the heater, the door, the windows, other children who have attention issues. And to break up tasks, teach how to divide a future task into manageable parts. In terms of giving instructions for ADHD students, it's important often to provide an external source of motivation. She had mentioned taking away the Xbox, but we also want to provide an incentive. If you write this, you'll get an extra 15 minutes of Xbox. I have a child who loves Gilmore Girls, and so one of her incentives for following through on the morning routine without having a tantrum, for which she had a checklist, is that she got an extra 15 minutes of Gilmore Girls at night. It's important for teachers to remember that ADHD kids might need manipulatives or like a little fidget toy, and to make tasks as manual as possible when needed. It's also important for parents to remember that, that there might be knee tapping or finger, I guess, twitching, whatever you want to call it. But there's usually some sort of outlet for a kind of internal sense of energy. And that timeouts have to be targeted and limited. And that's important at home, but also important at school. You know, the basic rule of thumb is that timeouts shouldn't be longer than the child's age, which I support. And I think that sometimes in school that the timeouts, again, have to be targeted for specific kinds of behavior and not just general across-the-board behaviors, because we want to work with the school and the parent on the same behavior so that there's success in that one area of behavior, and then we can move on to another. It's important to be patient during transitions of all types and to create a quiet place in the classroom which has reduced stimuli, if that's possible, or a place in school that has reduced stimuli. I had one student who really had to read in her English class, and she couldn't stand reading. It was distracting, the chairs were uncomfortable, and we were able to arrange with the school that she could go down to the library, which had a big, soft, cozy chair, and she could sit there and read when there was in-class reading. For classroom strategies, what we want to encourage teachers to do is to use external cues. Don't rely on mental or auditory information. Make lists, posters, signs. Remember that sometimes auditory processing for kids with ADHD is not their strongest way of learning, and sometimes it is. So sometimes people really learn only through hearing. I have a client who's an adult, and she basically, that's how she remembers all her information. That's how she processes, and that's how she remembers hearing and doing. I have another client who's an adult who has ADHD, and he has to write things down. And he has to see them visually. And they said that they've had these strategies and ways of learning since they were children. And I see that in the kids I work with, which is so interesting to be able to see it in kids and teenagers and then in people in, you know, their 40s and 50s. We want to make time physical in a classroom. Don't rely on internal clocks. You know, you want to help the child have a timer or some way of monitoring the time that's more external and physical, because they can't bind events across time. You want to help the child break up tasks. The teachers need to teach them how to divide up a task into the event, the response, and the outcome. It's nice to seat a child near the teacher, but as part of the regular class seating. I've seen teachers basically put a kid with ADHD right next to their desk, and then everyone else is in a circle. And all that does is make the child feel alienated and different in a very bad way. How do teachers address behavioral challenges in the classroom? First, they have to calmly is the big word, restate the infraction of the rule and do not debate or argue with the student. Second, they have to have some pre-established consequences for a misbehavior. Third, they need to administer the consequences immediately and support proper behavior with encouragement. And four, you have to enforce the rules of the classroom consistently. This is very hard to do when you have classes of 20, 25, sometimes 30 kids in a class. And so for teachers, it's really helpful if you work in a school and you have school-based practice to offer them or figure out with them how they can get supervision, discipline in the if it's very important for teachers, if you work in a school-based practice, to help them get supervision and peer support and brainstorming ideas to deal with these kinds of challenging behaviors so that they're not feeling all alone in a classroom with a child and they don't end up sort of, you know, blaming the child and not purposefully, although sometimes maybe purposefully, sort of singling out that child. It's important that teachers avoid ridicule and criticism publicly of a child, of course at all times, but especially kids with ADHD, because the belief in society is they could change it if they wanted to. And the reality is, as we've talked about today, that things don't just change because you want them to if you have ADHD, that this is a biologically based disorder. And if and it's based in the brain. And so there are a lot of very complicated factors that go along with it. You want to help a child build self-esteem. And that's through positive reinforcement, whether you call it reward or praise, and noticing when things are going well, noticing when a child is doing a good job. And teach the child to reward him or herself through self-talk. You know, that's your job as the therapist. What does the child say to him or herself when something's gone well? Does the child say, I was lucky? Or, yeah, but, you know, last time it was really bad, or just wait till next time? Or does the child say, good job, I'm making progress? My bet is the child doesn't very often say the last one, and that's what we want to help that child learn to say. So what do we want to keep in mind here? What are the top 10 reasons for procrastinating? A sense of humor goes a long way. We want to help families and teachers and kids with ADHD themselves be able to laugh at some of the things they do and not shame themselves or hate themselves for it. Homeschool collaboration is essential for academic success. Executive functioning problems are not motivational deficits, but skill deficits, and those skills need to be taught from infancy to adulthood. And parents have to teach them, and teachers have to teach them, and therapists and psychologists have to teach them to people with ADHD. They do not come naturally. In fact, they don't really come naturally to anyone. It's just that people who don't have ADHD learn them more readily than people who do. ADHD is a medical condition. It is not a failure of will. It is not a choice. And it's important to remember, as Ross Green says, kids do well if they can. And if they can't, what is getting in the way of them not doing well? Adult support is key to successful interventions and lifelong learning skills. In this way, coaching can be extremely helpful. having someone at the school who's a touchstone for a child with ADHD, even 5-10 minutes a day, can be extremely helpful. Keep in mind, executive functions provide structure, organize time, involve initiation, help a person understand and organize and live in their environment. And to use these executive functions, there are some tips. Give reminders, or what we would call cues. Use calendars. Try to stay calm and supportive if you're a family member or a professional involved with this child. Avoid negative labels. Parenthetically, ask what negative labels that child has about him or herself. Provide breaks. Praise efforts that you see toward change and doing things differently. And create scaffolding and sustain it longer than you think it might be necessary. Get well organized enough to achieve your goals. We've been talking about this today, or the importance of organization, and actually have said that, you know, getting organized is a goal in and of itself. But in general, getting organized is a means to an end. So identifying what that end is and then figuring out what kinds of organization you need to get to that end is part of the process of building executive functioning skills. And we want to help the kids and teens and young adults we work with do that. Ask for and heed advice from people you trust. Well, sometimes that can be challenging for all of us. I think it's sometimes especially hard for young people with ADHD because of the shame that I've referred to and the general sense of not getting things right. So we want to help them learn how to ask for assistance without feeling embarrassed. And that's an ongoing process. It's not an easy one. But it's really critical to their success in whatever endeavor they embark on. Keep up regular contact with a few close friends. You know, friendships nurture us throughout our whole lives. And sometimes for children with ADHD, making friends is hard because they misread the social cues around them. Sometimes they're so focused on making friends that they have a lot of sort of peripheral friendships but no real intimacy. Sometimes they can be over-focused on one person. So one of the things that's important to think about when we work with kids with ADHD is to help them understand what it means to be a friend, what to expect from another person, but also what to expect from yourself. The last habit that Halliwell identifies is go with your positive side, which I think is just a great thing to think about, which is lead with your strength. And one of our tasks as therapists is to help identify what that strength is in the family, in school, in work, socially. What are those strengths and how can we really nourish them so that they continue to grow and that these kids can feel like there are things they are good at. Finally, another quote from Delivered from Distraction, and you don't give up. That is another trait of people with ADD. They keep trying. Often they keep trying the same doomed way, but they do keep trying. So we want to try to help them try in different ways, to think in different categories, and ultimately to use that innate desire to keep trying to their best interest so that their efforts feel rewarding to them. Thank you so much for participating in understanding ADHD and executive functioning in children and adolescents. I hope this information will be useful to you in your practice, and I hope that you have a wonderful day.